So thank you very much for the honour of this invitation. I know we haven't a lot of time, and I'm going to pack in so much into this few minutes, so I'm going to rush along a little bit, if you'll forgive me. I want to begin by saying this, that you may be far away from Europe, and you may be a long way, both in economic terms, but also in sheer mileage terms, from the crisis in Europe. But I hope that it doesn't mean you don't see what is really happening. Because what is happening is the collapse, the intellectual, as well as the financial collapse of the neoliberal, liberalized economic system. Now, there's an awful lot of denial about this. There's an awful lot of attempts to shore up the liberalized financial system. Bankers are rushing around Europe in a total panic, trying to raise taxpayer finance to bail them out of their losses. Taxpayers, as we saw in the German parliament yesterday, are resisting, the German and court. They are resisting, and there is an enormous struggle going on. And I'm afraid that it's a struggle that the bankers will lose. What we're looking at is the fact that European banks are effectively insolvent. They're refusing to accept this, but let me tell you why I'm convinced of that. You know, August is a dead month in Britain. Everybody goes on a holiday. Nobody's at home. Nothing's happening. We have riots suddenly. We have the financial crisis breaks out. And this is because the European governments have promised to increase the pot of money which is going to be used to bail out the private banking system because they made lousy, unpayable loans to sovereign governments, as well as to companies and ordinary individuals and households that everyone knows will not be repaid, ever. So there was a pot of money, it was something like €400 billion, and the European governments have promised to increase it. But we do have democratic systems in Europe, believe it or not, after hundreds of years of struggle, and they have to go back and consult their parliaments, and they're doing that in September. But the banks could not wait until September. They demanded the money, they demanded the shoring up through August. And of course, all the politicians were on holiday. So the stock market started to pile on the pressure. So this is just one indication of the struggle that's going on there. And I also want you to be clear about this, because I see how this argument is playing out in Australia as well. You need to be very clear. This is not a crisis of government finances. This is not a fiscal crisis. This is a crisis of the banking system, of the private liberalized banking system. And it's a crisis that the private liberalized banking system is trying to transfer the burden of onto the public sector. It's already transferred a massive burden of losses onto the European public sector, onto taxpayers, onto workers, onto ordinary people in Europe. It wants to transfer more of its losses onto those people, and there is resistance naturally building up to that. But first and foremost, this is a financial crisis of the private banking system. And we had the chief executive of the Royal Bank of Scotland on the radio in Britain saying this is a government public fiscal crisis. This is nothing to do with the private sector. So that is how keen they are to, if you like, push responsibility for this crisis onto the governments. That's not to say that governments have done everything correctly or that things have gone well, but the fact of the matter is that this is a private financial crisis brought about by an ideology. And let's be clear about this, it's an ideology, and I see it played out here in Australia. I read the papers yesterday, I read about the New South Wales budget, I read the Financial Review saying that the Mr. O'Farrell, I think he's called, hadn't gone far enough, that he hadn't cut enough, that he hadn't threatened to sack enough people. I see also that the Labour government is planning a fiscal contraction over the next 2 years, which, according to the current Treasury Secretary, is going to be the fastest contraction in fiscal contraction that Australia's ever experienced. And that's going to take place between now and 2013. And this is the ideology that I want to discuss with you this morning. But let me first of all introduce the Green New Deal. This is why I'm here and this is what I'm about. I worked with a group of economists to build something, a case for the Green New Deal. There were a bunch of us in this, you know, some of us quite formidable, some of us quite junior, really. Caroline Lucas, the leader of the Green Party in England and the first Green to be elected to Parliament, is a member of the group. Larry Elliott, who's the economics editor of The Guardian. Tony Juniper, who used to run Friends of the Earth. Myself and others. But I was there with others trying to represent the labour movement in this group, which was dominated by Greens and industrialists, people in solar technology. And we published this in July 21, 2008, but we'd been working on it since 2007, before the crisis really exploded. And it got an awful lot of coverage around the world, as you can see. You know, the words Green New Deal have appeared in an awful lot of places and in an awful lot of statements. The UN, South Korean ministers of the environment, Japanese ministers of the environment, and so on. And they've all used the language of the Green New Deal, but I doubt they've done and they've approached it in the way that we were approaching it. So what informed the development of the Green New Deal? What were we trying to do? We were trying to address at that point what we defined as a triple crunch: the financial crisis, peak oil, and climate change. We've had to add other crunches to that because we now face a food crunch, a commodities crunch. We face a water crunch too. But at that point, these were the three crunches we outlined. But something that I think might be relevant to your situation is that what I tried to do and what my colleagues and I tried to do as part of that group was to build an alliance between the green movement, the labor movement, and industry, people engaged in making real things, people engaged in real productive economic activity as opposed to what I call ephemeral financial speculation, to challenge the finance sector and their dominance of the real economy and their destructive approach towards the real economy. Now, that's a tough call. When it happened, when we were trying to do this, the Greens were busy in Kent trying to block the building of a coal-fired power station, King's North in Kent. On one side was the labor movement and the police and industry, and on the other side were the Greens. And it was very hard for us to explain to the Greens the anxieties felt by miners in Britain whose communities, whose sector had been destroyed by Thatcher's government. And the result of that destruction is that we have whole communities in Britain where people are unemployed, where there is social breakdown, where there's a drugs epidemic, where young people have no hope and no future. And so the Greens attacking the possibility of more jobs in mines seemed to the labor movement to be irrational and unfair. And equally, the Greens have got a powerful case on what carbon emissions from coal does for the environment. And what we feel, is that we may have our big differences. I feel about the green movement, while it is absolutely right on the ecosystem and the environment, where there tends to be a weakness is in its failure to understand that we need to have a job-rich green economy, that we need to have full employment. I get the sense sometimes from green activists that they wouldn't care too much if we didn't have full employment. And I find that shocking. And I find that shocking because we know that if we don't have full employment, we will have social breakdown. It's absolutely essential to us as human beings to feel that we belong and that we have value and that we can contribute to our society. And the whole argument, I think, revolves around the notion of growth, which is an ideological, capitalist, free market notion. And what we decided when drafting the Green New Deal, that we would try very hard not to use the word growth, that we understand that you cannot have endless, unlimited growth when we have limited, finite resources in nature. And I feel very strongly about this, and I'm watching what happens here in Australia with iron ore and so on, because I grew up in a small gold mining town in the Orange Free State in South Africa, you know, in our outback. It was a pretty wild, crazy kind of place. There was a gold rush there in 1947. My dad went down there because he was unemployed. He didn't know what he was going to do. He'd come out of the war a hero, and he had no work. He had four kids. What in the hell was he going to do? And we ended up in this little town where I grew up. And when I grew up, two things happened. One, the price of gold never changed. And that was because of the Bretton Woods system. It stayed at $35 an ounce for, you know, 40 years or so. And I remember getting in my dad's van and leaning over and trying to understand why the gold price sat at $35 an ounce and every other price changed. And there's my dad who left school at 17 to go to war because he thought that would be more exciting than school, and who wasn't really very educated, trying to explain to me the financial architecture of the Bretton Woods system. We struggled, but we got there. But what was very striking was that, you know, I lived through the gold boom in Velkom, it's called. My town was actually a little place called Oudendalsrus, and I challenge you to look it up on the map. It was a very small town. And then Velkom was where all the big, deep gold mines were dug. Today, there is no gold in my town. We dug it all up. It's all gone. There ain't no more gold in the gold fields of the Orange Free State. And you need to remind yourselves of that, too. We have finite resources out there, and we have to nurture them and use them carefully. So the Greens have got a point about that. But the fact of it is this. We may not be able to have growth in our economies, but we must always have economic activity. And so if we replace the word growth with economic activity, we start to talk about job-rich economic activity, which is the kind of activity that would involve, for example, creating works of art. I've had the privilege of seeing the Aboriginal exhibition in the National Museum in Canberra while on this trip. Creating works of art, wonderful music, caring for the sick, educating people. That's all that involves economic activity. But it needn't necessarily involve growth. We've got to find ways of engaging people in economic activity without extracting assets from the earth. So that's a thing, I think, that's got to help us bring the Green and the labor movement and industry together so that we can understand what it is that we really want to be about. But the key thing about this statement is that we may have our differences, but honestly, guys, we are the good guys. We are trying to make something. We're trying to do something. We care about the environment. Sometimes we care about the environment more than people. Sometimes we care about people more than the environment. But those are all good motivations. The really bad guys in my book are the finance sector. And we have to have some clarity about that. We have to have some clarity in our own minds about why it is. You know, for example, I was hearing on the radio this morning about Australia's enormous houses and about Australia's fantastic property boom. That's not because Australians want bigger, bigger houses than anybody else and have a kind of human need that the rest of us don't have. It's because of the availability of credit in Australia's economy, which fuels asset prices, which fuels the prices of these assets like property. So what the Green New Deal about is how do we finance a response to the great triple crunch? How do we now find the money to transform our economy so that it's no longer fossil fuel dependent? That's going to take a massive transformation of the economy. We have big coal mines here, we have iron ore mines, we have all these cars driving around. We have a big job to do, and our politicians, but above all, our orthodox economists are telling us there ain't enough money in the bank. And if there's one thing that I want you to take away from this talk today, it is the notion that there is actually no shortage at all of the finance that we need to transform our economy. And I want you to, if you think this is something you're going to be skeptical of, I want you to imagine what we'd be doing right now if Hitler arrived on the scene and we were going to war, and I'm thinking here particularly of Britain. When Hitler threatened Britain with occupation and death and destruction, gosh, the finance flowed. We found the money. We fought the war. We borrowed more than we'd ever borrowed in history, and we came through. The idea that this threat of climate change and peak oil and peak water and peak food isn't as grave a threat as that was to the survival of Britain in 1939 is ludicrous. It is equally grave a threat. And we found money for that, and we can find money for this. And if you also, you're still skeptical that there is actually the finance we need, let me remind you what the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve of the United States, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan did after the banks went bust in 2007-08. They found $14 trillion across the world to bail out the financial system. $14 trillion. And I tell you, they didn't raise it from taxpayers, but we'll come to that. And the point is this. They found $14 trillion to bail out the financial system. The United Nations Environment Programme says we need $1.2 trillion a year across the world to bail out the ecosystem. I think that's an underestimate, and they say we need that until 2050. But if we could find $14 trillion in 2 years to bail out the banks, we can find at least $2-3 trillion a year to bail out the ecosystem. I want you to go away with that conviction. But before we do, I just want to say we need to understand the nature of finance, and we need to understand how we go about this. Let me just quickly hop across to this graph, this chart. There is a grave misunderstanding amongst all of us and amongst our politicians, policymakers, but above all, amongst our economists as to the nature of money and credit. And if you don't understand money and credit, really, you can make very, very big economic mistakes. Now, we've understood money and credit since the Florentine bankers first set up a banking system way back in the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries, and the Dutch picked up on that banking system, and in 1694, the British finally came to understand what the Florentines and the Dutch were doing, and in 1694 established the Bank of England. That had a major impact on our economy. That meant that after that, the Industrial Revolution was able to happen. But that's because we had a banking system that could create credit. Now, the orthodox economists argue that in order to have enough money to transform the economy, to pay for education, to employ people, to look after the sick, all of that stuff, you have to have savings in the bank. You have to have accumulated a surplus. So in orthodox economics, if I can be very crude about this, the idea is this. You find a piece of land, they don't tell you how, you get some seed, you plant your tomatoes, you grow your tomatoes, you harvest them, you take them to market, you sell them, you make a surplus, and then you have savings. You have a surplus. Only then, say the orthodox economists, can you invest in, you know, a wind turbine. In reality, it's the reverse. Keynes and many other economists before him and the Bank of England in 1694 understood that you can't have the land or the seeds without credit, that credit is the first thing that stimulates economic activity. Then what happens is the credit creates economic activity. The farmer can sow his seed, he can plant his tomatoes, he can harvest them, he can even then take them to market to sell. That generates income for the farmer. The income generates deposits in the bank, which tends to pay for the credit. It generates savings, and it generates tax revenues in a financial system, a banking system, that has both a sound banking system but also a sound tax collection system. So it works the opposite way to what the orthodox economists argue. Keynes said, credit creates savings and deposits. Now, when you tell that to, you know, Hayek and Friedman and all of their followers in your governments today, in your government in Australia, they think that is nonsense, except when it comes to bailing out the banking system. Suddenly, they're able to do that. I heard an interview with Tim Geithner, This is not a really wonderful graph, but I heard an interview with Tim Geithner, who's one of the most powerful finance ministers in the world. He's in charge of the American Treasury. And they said to him, he had to give evidence to a select committee, and he had to explain the banking system. And he said, the banking system is something, he was very patronizing in the way he explained it. I quoted it, but I've taken it out of here. He said, you know, it's for those people who have savings, to lend their savings to these people here who want to borrow to go on holiday or buy a home or a caravan or such thing. And the banks, had said, simply exist there to act as intermediaries between savers and borrowers. This chart shows you how much Americans were saving from 2000 onwards and how much they were borrowing. The line that plunges down below zero is the savings line. Okay, savings went negative after 2000 in the United States. The line that soars upwards is the borrowing line. Now, where do you think Americans were getting, what were the banks doing if they were simply exchanging savings to borrowers and borrowers were taking savings? Do you get my point? It just, there was a big hole there, and that hole is filled by credit. It's filled by a promise to give you money. Now, how is credit created? Now, this is a mystery to most people. Where did that $14 trillion come from? The fact is, it came out of, you know, the blue sky, literally. So Ben Bernanke, I have to rate him. There's lots wrong with him, but he's the only governor of a Federal Reserve that's given an interview to the television. And in February 2009, he was interviewed about the whole financial crisis. And the day before, he'd found $160 billion to bail out a company called AIG, which is not a bank, it's an insurance company. It should not have had an account with the Fed because, you know, in the banking system, the central bank has only got accounts.